Welcome to another edition of the podcast. Today, we are here to discuss the work and intellectual legacy of a preeminent but underappreciated scholar of Islam in West Africa and North Africa, William A. Brown. A set of scholars came together to help us understand and also appreciate the depth and scope of the contributions of the works of this great scholar who is no longer with us, but whose work has proved to be very influential. Here today, I have two of those authors. Professor Sean Hanretta and Professor Usman Kobo are also the authors of the introduction to this History Matters series on William A. Brown. I have a few questions based on their introduction that I hope will help us to appreciate the work, the influence, and the legacy of this great scholar. You're welcome, Usman. Welcome, Sean.
Thank you.
If you could sum up the intellectual legacy of William A. Brown, what would that be? Let's start with Usman.
I would say Professor Bill Brown, as we call him, was a great scholar of Islam in Africa and also a great scholar of world history in general. But I'll let Sean speak more specifically about his great achievement in the development of the history of Islam in West Africa. I would like to speak more about his mentorship.
Sean, how would you summarize William A. Brown's intellectual legacy?
Thank you, Moses. My answer is going to perhaps overlap slightly with some of the things that Usman may say, because I do think it's difficult in Brown's case to disentangle the impact of his scholarship from the impact of his teaching and mentorship. I think this is partly because he did not publish a great deal. Most of those who were influenced profoundly by his work were specialists who sought out and made use of his unpublished dissertation. So those scholars that I, you know, had communicated with personally or whose work I had read either said that it was through his dissertation or they cited his dissertation, which isn't to say that those other short publications were neglected. Some of them were quite important. And as the piece contributed to the journal by Mara Nobili and Said Buspina suggests, also his kind of work in archiving, conserving, right? So photographing Arabic manuscripts in particular, and then making those available to other people, had a lasting legacy. So those other kinds of efforts of his were very important, but it was primarily through the dissertation, I think, that his work had an impact. And there, I think it has to be seen in the context both of the work that people like Amadou Hampate Ba had done in collecting oral traditions on the history of Massina and the Dina before, as well as some of the things that were known about the Arabic literature, the Arabic language literature on that history. But for me, it was kind of the work that he did synthesizing those bodies of sources, but also the particular lens that he brought to the question of that movement's social significance that I think really resonated with people. And that was the fact that he tried to understand and really tried to use the oral traditions to situate the Arabic material in a particular socio-political context and understand why it was that people would follow Ahmed Lobo, why it was that people participated in this, how it was that Lobo's inner circle differed from, say, the scholars who were based in some place like Timbuktu, this kind of more cosmopolitan, established or well-known center of Islamic education, and really then kind of his ability to explore the tensions within the movement and within the state that resulted from it. And I think that that was really characteristic of two of Brown's deep commitments, one which was to a kind of, you know, Marxian social history that tried to understand the material interests, the ideological commitments of people that guided their actions, as well as the intellectual context of the leadership of the movement, right? So he was interested in the intellectual content of the Arabic material. He was interested in the intellectual ideas that were being put forward in the oral traditions, but he wanted to sort of situate both of those within the concrete social material circumstances of the people that were involved. And those really kind of, I think, did reflect then his two interests. One was in kind of taking Islam seriously as a faith and as a repository of ideas. And the other was taking the material circumstances of ordinary people seriously and trying to understand their lives from the ground up and what encouraged them to participate in one movement or another. Looking at then the range of scholars that benefited from Brown's work or drew on his dissertation, again, the dissertation in particular, I think it was the fact that he spoke to those issues and their relationship to one another that made it such a significant work.
That was quite interesting, Sean. Given the depth and the breadth and the influence of his contributions that you've just outlined, Usman, I was struck by something both of you wrote in the introduction, that William Brown was more admired than understood and more ignored than admired. I thought that was quite interesting. Why has he been ignored for the most part? And why also for the most part has he been inadequately understood?
Thanks for that question. In my opinion, I think Professor Brown himself was very humble, did not really push or advertise himself sufficiently. When I arrived in Madison, Wisconsin, when you speak with him, he's extremely brilliant, but he hardly wanted to talk about his own work. I do remember in one class, copies of his dissertation with us, and we wanted to delve into the dissertation. He did very little. So in a way, I think he himself did not push himself on the academic landscape the way other scholars probably did. Also because he did not publish much, so folks were not really reaching out to him the way they could have done. But those of us who were right on campus with him were able to extract some of the information, some of his, what should I say, the archive in his head. That's the way I describe it, right? The archive in his head. So he was not ignored by his students. We still talk about him. He did not make it into the intellectual landscape like some of his colleagues did, probably because he deliberately, consciously refused to publish his dissertation.
That's amazing. Sean, going off of what Usman just articulated for us regarding the choices that he made as a scholar, I mean, obviously, he followed an unconventional academic path, right? You know, he deliberately refused to publish many papers. He prioritized teaching and mentorship. And I was struck by the connection you drew between that and the current trend on decolonizing knowledge and institutional self-criticism. Could you elaborate on the connection between that? What do those choices that he made teach us about this new moment? And how can we learn from his example?
Thank you, Moses. This is, you know, I think, a very deep and important topic. I think, you know, one of the difficulties in talking about Brown is that, of course, one is sort of reconstructing motives and reconstructing decisions on the basis of anecdotal and kind of fragmentary evidence, right? So I can only sort of speculate on some of these things. You know, it was my sense that he was interested in publishing a book from his dissertation, but that he was not necessarily willing to make some of the edits, particularly around issues of length, that would have been required for it to be a practical undertaking in sort of relatively recent publishing landscapes. I think his relatively scant publication record reflected a couple of things. I mean, I think it reflected a sense of real alienation from the field. I don't think that he thought that there was much of a receptive audience, rightly or wrongly, for the approach that he was taking. But I also do think that he became increasingly aware of the, maybe we could say, sort of, you know, institutional asymmetries, institutional power asymmetries between scholars based in the global north and those based on the continent. I remember a very early paper that I wrote for him came back, you know, without any line edits or sort of comments on my argument directly, but starting on the back of the final page and then sort of working about halfway through the entire length of the paper was a handwritten comment that sort of started, I don't think that anyone can comment more cogently on these topics than an African historian. And then he proceeded to quote Ajayi over the course of about 7 pages. And, you know, I think that that did reflect his own unease, you know, maybe less about his own privilege vis-a-vis those scholars than that of the intellectual environment or kind of the intellectual landscape in which he found himself. He, you know, had I think, quite cordial relations with the specific faculty in the African history program at the times that he was there. But I think he was quite skeptical of the Department of History. He was certainly quite skeptical of African history graduate students. I mean, I don't know if Usman, if you would sort of share quite this take on it, but you know, my sense was always very much that he sort of assumed that most of the graduate students coming through the department weren't really serious enough to be worth his time or weren't politically engaged enough to be worth his time. And there was a set of tests then that he established for people before he would really take you seriously and work with you. And I you know, I don't know that I actually ever passed any of those tests, but I think I just sort of wore him down after enough years of pestering him. And I think that that did reflect then, you know, a commitment to certain ideas and values that we would associate now with the kind of critiques that are taking place of the way the academy operates.
Now, Usman, one of the things that William Brown was known for, which has defined also his reputation in the field, is as a collector of Arabic manuscripts, Ajami manuscripts, but also oral tradition. I'm curious to know from you, Usman, how important and foundational were this other side of his scholarly persona, and how are we indebted to him in that regard as historians of West Africa?
Yes, thank you very much, Moses. I think, in a way, Professor Brown was among the first American scholars of color, one of the first black scholars, to really pay very close attention to, as Sean said earlier, the relationship between oral materials and written materials. And he was very critical of both. He was very critical about the nature of oral history, very meticulous in terms of what he would consider valid historical evidence coming from the oral domain. He does the same with the Arabic manuscript. I do remember in one conversation, and these are not written, right? So it's very difficult. Sometimes we just, as Sean said, we have to speculate. But I do remember one time when I was reading Tariq Fattah, and he told me, you need to be very careful of what these North Africans were writing about Black African society, because they come in with their own specific lenses and with their own ideological inclination. So in a way, I've always conceived Bill Brown a nationalist scholar, an African nationalist scholar, one who wants to preserve African intellectual legacy, but at the same time being critical of that legacy as any scholar would be expected to do.
Sean, you guys are right in the introduction about how William Brown was committed to what you call emancipatory potential of African history. I'd like you to speak to that, if you could, Sean. But I would like to tack on another sort of thing that intrigued me in this introduction, which is William Brown as an intellectual and an academic nomad. You know, he held positions all over the world. Even in Nigeria, I just saw in the introduction that he was at Ahmadu Bello University, with which I'm very familiar, at Yale University, Harvard University. He was all over this. Of course, Mali. His academic nomadism, as it were, how does that connect to this view that he had, that you guys articulate so well in the introduction, about his commitment to African history as an emancipatory practice?
Thanks. I think, you know, maybe one way into that that also connects up with what Usman was just saying would be to look at the way that he critiqued oral traditions, right? As Usman said, he was by no means kind of naive, right, about the factual nature of much of the material contained in those traditions. But at the same time, the grounds on which he would critique evidence coming from them were quite different from the grounds that I think were, you know, being invoked in those days for being skeptical of oral traditions, right? And so in particular, he took issue with what he saw as kind of the legacy of structural functionalism and sort of the assumption that narrators of oral traditions and, you know, the authors of Arabic manuscripts or producers of other kinds of sources did not have an intrinsic commitment to historical accuracy, right? That they were shaped purely by the social pressures of the societies in which they lived, and that therefore their narratives were functional, right? Rather than being scholarly. It's not then that he, you know, dismissed or ignored the potential tendentiousness or the potential interests that someone might have had in crafting a narrative one way or another, whether in writing or in speech, but rather he believed quite firmly that oral traditionalists and the authors of Arabic manuscripts believed they themselves, right, were deeply committed to getting the story correct, and that they had a kind of realist position about the past, that they believed that there was something that actually happened, that one could, you know, do one's best to know about it, that they had their own sort of methods of source criticism that they applied in producing those accounts, and that we had to take them seriously as the products of historical labor, rather than sort of simply seeing them as cultural artifacts that reflected social structures or whatever, right? And so when he would go into critique them, what he would do would end up looking quite different from what, say, some people who would look at oral traditions and be skeptical about their utility and want to try to unpack the ways in which they reflected, you know, operated as a social constitution for the moments in which they were being produced or something like that, right? That was not his approach. And in fact, he found that approach deeply offensive. There was a kind of constant tension between the ways in which he was skeptical of evidence and some of the ways in which, you know, Vansina had come in for critique for being maybe too sanguine about the utility of oral history at that oral tradition in those times, right? And people were pointing out the limitations of oral traditions. And again, it's not that Brown was you know, dismissive of those concerns either. You know, and he was not uncritical of Vansina, right? He saw Vansina as sort of also having internalized, perhaps, you know, unwittingly, right? But having internalized some of those kinds of structuralist, functionalist assumptions. But he found himself, I think, much closer to Vansina's position in terms of the utility of those sources and taking them seriously. And I think, you know, so it was on that level of thinking about the, you know, the kind of epistemology of African history that I think he wanted to insert that kind of radical politics. You know, yes, of course, it was the topics that he wrote about. Yes, it was the perspectives, the stories that were told, the kind of counter narratives that were produced to push back against discriminatory, belittling, dismissive, whatever kind of narratives that were being generated within Europe and the United States that he found so troubling. And that he found is kind of, you know, underpinning global white supremacy. But, you know, it was kind of at that level of the ways in which those assumptions were manifested and the ways that people thought about evidence that I think he, you know, was particularly keen on getting at.
Usman, you write in the introduction that Brown challenged these racist and orientalist assumptions on West African Islamic history. I find that quite fascinating. I wanted to connect that to scholar activism in the era of decolonization and civil rights in the 60s. That's where he did most of his pioneering work. And I wanted to push you to help us understand the connection between the two. How did the intellectual moment of decolonization and civil rights inform some of this vehement challenge to Orientalism and racism in the production of West African Islamic historical knowledge?
Thank you. That's a very good question. Earlier, I mentioned that I've always seen Professor Brown as an intellectual, African intellectual nationalist. And I see him as a nationalist because one could identify him at the intersection of the anti-colonial struggles, changes in knowledge production. As Sean mentioned earlier, his epistemological approach. If today we are looking at Africanizing knowledge, right, perhaps Professor Brown was doing so in the 1960s. So one of the things that in my conversation with him that I discovered is that he would prioritize an African perspective relative to a European perspective. And his argument one time in the conversation is that those who live within a historical moment know it better. Right? So whatever they have written should be taken seriously, but it should be viewed against the specific academic approach. He advised me not to just take oral narrative on its face value. I should also dig deeper to assess the value of that knowledge, the social moment and political moment of the production of that knowledge. So this is some of the things that I learned from him. I think he's well positioned in terms of these multiple forces that were occurring in the 1960s, right? Anti-colonialism discourse. And then, of course, attempts to give priority to knowledge produced by Africans themselves. I'm trying to be very careful here because it does not assume that he has abandoned the Western epistemological approach, which was dominant at the time. He did not shy away from it. He was critical about its limitation in the same way he would be critical about the potential limitations of some of the African sources that we were collecting.
Both of you write in the introduction something that really, really piqued my interest. And I'll turn it into a question. How did the Marxist atheist come to be such an iconic, you know, an influential scholar of West African Islamic history? I also wanted to connect it to the question about his dissertation itself. There have been very few unpublished dissertations that have had the influence of that work.
I mean, I think the question about his relationship to religion in some ways, right, turns on the respect that he had for West African intellectuals. I think that if he had a criticism of some of his contemporaries, and there were people that he certainly singled out as being exceptions to this, he was a deep admirer of Lewis Brunner's work, who he thought also kind of took the intellectual content of West African Muslim intellectuals seriously. He proceeded from that position of respect. And it's not that he then neglected a kind of Marxian approach to understanding religion, its effects. I mean, he was very interested in kind of the ways in which Islam could legitimate both emancipatory and, you know, oppressive political institutions. And so it kind of came back to that question on some level, right? What were the actual political consequences of these ideas? But he took those ideas seriously as having their own kind of formal integrity, proceeding from, you know, a set of premises and sort of the seriousness of the work in which that Muslim intellectuals carried out in applying those ideas to their own ethical situations, their own ethical decisions. There wasn't really that much tension. I mean, I think he enjoyed pointing out, right, this irony, because he found more kind of conservative historians who might have then otherwise been imagined to be more sympathetic to religion as in fact really kind of smuggling in a fair amount of condescension towards Islam, whether because they, you know, were subscribed to some kind of modernizationist, theory, or because they had different confessional commitments or whatever. I think that other scholars that were interested in the relationship between ideology, material reality, and particularly kind of in the long durée, I mean, he was a deep admirer of both of the McIntoshes, right? And so it was scholars like that he felt a certain kind of kinship with. And I think it's probably also those scholars then to kind of, maybe this is my inelegant segue into your other question, right? Who found a lot of utility in his dissertation. I mean, obviously anyone who was kind of working on Massina Alhamdulahi, the in the Niger Delta in the 19th century would end up reading that dissertation at one point or another. And again, it's not that it treated oral sources that hadn't been treated before. I mean, you know, Bandage had done some of that work. There were people that had looked at those Arabic materials. But systematicity with which he did it and the kinds of questions that he asked and the ways that he kind of mapped it onto non-religious questions, right, or linked it up with non-religious questions, I think made it really useful for people like, say, I mean, again, you know, Rod McIntosh was one of the people who mentioned, right, being influenced by the, you know, finding use in the dissertation. And I suspect it was because of that, right? I shouldn't speak for him. But so I think that, obviously, you know, it's a topic itself that generated tremendous interest, right? There was a huge boom, still is, right? Tremendous amount of interest in these 19th century movements. And so while, of course, most of the attention tends to go to either northern Nigeria or Senegambia, you know, the importance of what was happening in what's now Mali at that time, you know, is widely acknowledged. And so, you know, if you were going to talk about that, Brown's work was unavoidable. So it had influence in that kind of capacity too. But I think even people whose interests were, you know, different from that or broader than that, like say, you know, the McIntoshes or Brenner, found something of use in Brown's work precisely just because of the sophistication and the insistence on kind of putting both religion and social life in the same framework.
Yeah, thank you. And Kobo, you write in your individual piece in this collection And it also comes through in the introduction that Brown prioritized informal mentorship over formal doctoral advising. I mean, you took classes with him and you write about your experience. How was he like as a teacher and as a mentor? Just give us a window to understand his pedagogical temperament, his mentorship ideals, and how that helps us to understand mentorship beyond formal doctoral training and advising.
Well, thank you, Moses. That's a very good question. It's a question that I have reflected on several times. When I arrived in Madison to begin my graduate studies, naturally, I was looking for someone of my color, and I saw Bill Brown, and my initial assumption was that, boy, this is the person who would be my advisor, right? He works in the area that I was interested in, West African Islamic history. He's, of course, Black. So I said, this is done. I mean, I have a mentor. But I soon realized that he was not interested in that formal academic mentorship. So he would not take me on as his advisee. Then I had to find a way. I said, okay, so how do I get to tap into this wealth of knowledge that this man possesses? And I established a relationship with him. So every time I see him, I use the moment to learn whatever I could learn and also to seek advice. I think he understood that. He understood that I was indirectly coming in through the back door to achieve my objective of he giving me the necessary mentorship. One thing that I could talk about in terms of his mentorship is that even though he was not taking on any graduate students more directly, at least he didn't do so with me, he also was never selfish in terms of sharing his knowledge. He was very open, and we could talk with him anywhere we meet him, right? At night, daytime, it doesn't matter. You can hold a conversation with him, and every moment of conversation is an asset, intellectual asset for. The other way that I found him to be very interesting is that his critical approach to knowledge, he transmits that in the classroom. One example that still sticks out with me, when I wrote my master's thesis, he was a member of the committee, and at the end, you know, he passed me, but at the end of my defense, he called me to his office and he gave me back my dissertation. He said, take it. How dare you, I'm paraphrasing, how dare you describe the Arabs as Arabizing Northern Africa? Because I wrote that Northern Africa was Arabized, right? And here he gave me almost a 30-minute lecture of intellectual nationalism. Don't ever use the fusionist idea, was one of the things that he told me. And do not ever use anecdotal as evidence. Using that specific example, there are Berbers in Northern Africa who still speak their own language. Arabic, almost the same from his perspective, plays the same role as English or French would play in other African countries today. So it is the form official language, but Middle Easterners did not Arabize Northern Africa because Berber still exists today. So these are some of the ways by which he indirectly, right, through conversation with him, through establishing cordial relationship with him, one would learn from his experience and of course, tap into his knowledge. So even when we describe his informal approach to mentorship, it should be viewed in terms of the student themselves being interested in reaching out to him and establishing that relationship. I learned, honestly, a lot from my informal relationship with him, probably than I did with my formal mentorship. So I see myself in two different ways, right? So there is the formal doctoral advising, which dealt mostly with the content of what I was doing, because my advisor was not a specialist of Islam. And then I went to Bill Brown for the fine tuning and the informal ways of mentoring. In fact, last semester, I was telling my grad students, when they made some comments about my mentorship, and I said, this came from Madison, Wisconsin, from the late Bill Brown.
Well, that's fantastic. That was a great way to end this. Well, we've come to the end of the podcast. The title of this fascinating introduction by Sean and Usman is William A. Brown and the Assessment of a Scholarly Life. It appears in the current issue of the Journal of African History, alongside the other pieces, the other individual pieces by different scholars, including the two that we've just talked to, assessing and celebrating the intellectual and academic contributions of William A. Brown. Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Usman, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us.